things. Kraner Center for the Performing Arts, a universe of experiences under one roof. And now stay tuned for today's episode of Disability Beat. This is Disability Beat, a public affairs program for and about people with disabilities. It's about social justice, community supports, inclusion, accessibility, freedom, and choice. My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for a pre-recorded commentary from May of last year on the grave situation at the Choate Developmental Center in Anna, Illinois. But first, disability news for the week of June 12, 2023. Disability advocates are praising a ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court last week that could have led to restrictions on the rights of people who are beneficiaries of Medicaid and other government programs. The court issued their opinion on the case, Health and Hospital Corporation of Marion County versus Tulefsky, brought by Ivanka Tulefsky, who alleged that her now deceased husband was chemically restrained and medicated so that he would go to sleep instead of being treated for his dementia while living in an Indiana nursing home. The 7-2 ruling in favor of Tulefsky safeguards the rights of people receiving services through programs like Medicaid to sue state and local governments if their civil rights are violated. Health and Hospital Corporation of Marion County, or HHC, had appealed to the Supreme Court, arguing that nursing home residents shouldn't be able to sue in federal court. According to Megan Schuler, legal director at the Bazelon Center for Mental Health Law, the decision was a major victory for people with disabilities. Schuler said, quote, "The Supreme Court rejected a cynical gambit to overturn decades of legal precedent and strike another legal blow to civil rights. Governments should be accountable to the people they serve and when they violate their rights, including under Medicaid law." Bazelon Center and other disability advocacy organizations supported the Tulefsky suit, saying that the case threatened the rights of millions of beneficiaries of Medicaid, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, the Children's Health Insurance Program, and temporary assistance to needy families, among other programs. Shira Wachschlag is the Senior Director of Legal Advocacy and General Counsel for the ARC of the United States. Wachschlag said, quote, "This is a monumental win for disability rights and the principles that a private right of action is critical to the access, accountability, and anti-discrimination of our country's Medicaid and safety net programs. It sets a crucial precedent that will have far-reaching implications for people with disabilities in our healthcare system, housing, nutrition, education, disability, and other safety net programs," end quote. Between the fall of 2019 and 2020, enrollment in early intervention and special education services for preschool-age children decreased by 15% across the nation. A recent report issued by the National Institute for Early Education Research at the Rutgers Graduate School of Education says that the numbers of young children with disabilities receiving early intervention and special education has decreased dramatically. The report also said that access to those services varies significantly by state. It is the first study amounting to a national audit and a state-by-state look at access to early intervention services for children up to age 3, as well as special education for children ages 3 to 5 who have not yet started kindergarten. For the report, researchers examined data from the 2021-2022 the 2020-21 school year and evaluated trends from 2005 through 2021. According to the report, 3.7% of children under age 3 received early intervention services in the fall of 2020, but access was not equitable. In Massachusetts, 10% of children were enrolled in the program, compared to just 1% in Arkansas and Hawaii. 6% of kids age 3 and 4 receive special ed services nationally, but that number ranged from a high of 14% in Wyoming to under 3% in Alabama. The report also said that children of color were less likely than others to be in early intervention or special education at young ages than white children, with black children experiencing the most discrepancies. The researchers also noted, however, that school-age black children are more likely than white children to be enrolled in special education. According to Steve Barnett, co-director of the National Institute for Early Education Research, which produced the report, quote, "The disparities that are documented in this equity audit are not just unfair, they're harmful," end quote. The researchers have recommended increasing government funding, more intensive equity audits in individual states, and bringing states together to discuss how to address the problems identified in the report. Catherine Neese is the Deputy Assistant Secretary in the Office of Special Education and Rehabilitative Services at the U.S. Department of Education. Neese called the finding disturbing and yet not shocking, and said her agency is taking steps to educate officials at the state and local level about their responsibilities to identify and serve young children with disabilities. Nee said, quote, "We know that when we help kids get the supports that they need at the earliest age, they have better life outcomes. I think we need to think creatively about what the solutions are to these problems," end quote. And finally, last weekend, President Joe Biden signed a bipartisan bill to suspend the debt limit, ending a standoff between Biden and Republican leaders in Congress who had refused to raise the debt ceiling without reducing spending. The bill included new limits on domestic spending over the next 2 years that will affect federal programs for people with disabilities, but left Medicaid intact. The final agreement effectively cuts spending on special education, housing, vocational rehabilitation, and many other programs by freezing levels until fiscal year 2025, when spending will see only a 1% increase that will likely not account for inflation. Zoe Gross, director of advocacy at the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, said it is unclear how the debt ceiling agreement will affect disability programs over the coming years. According to Gross, quote, "The debt ceiling isn't like the federal budget. It isn't a negotiation on how we spend money going forward. It's covering money we've already spent. Holding it hostage in order to force through harmful cuts was a political move that shouldn't have happened. We, of course, acknowledge that the deal could have been even worse for our community, but that isn't the same as being a good thing," end quote. And that's the news for this week.
Sitting in the sun, count my money, fanned by my summer breeze. Sweeter than the honey is counting my money, those greenbacks on the trees. Comes a summer shower, dry.
And you are tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. I'm Vicki Nicewander, and I'm joined today by no one. It's just me today. But I wanted to take a few moments to focus on the programs that we've done recently that focus heavily on recent crimes committed at Choate Developmental Center, which is in Anna, Illinois, as well as the practice of institutionalizing people in general. If you haven't guessed it yet, my opinion is that the closure of all these 7 remaining facilities in Illinois need to close. Today on this program, I'm going to talk about why I believe that so strongly. So first, I'm going to walk you through a definition of what I mean when I talk about state-operated developmental centers. A lot of people who listen to this program are not really familiar with that concept. So there are a number of points here, so stay with me. First of all, the state-operated developmental centers, as I said, of which there are only seven in the state of Illinois, include only people with disabilities. Nobody without a disability lives at one of these institutions. It is defined as an institution if it includes more than three people who have not chosen to live together, which would put a lot of people in an institutional category when you're talking about group homes. They do not permit residents to lock their doors to their bedroom or their bathroom. They enforce regimented meal and sleep times. You don't get a choice in what you eat, when you eat, or when you go to sleep or wake up. They limit visitors, including who may visit and when they can visit. They restrict when a resident may enter or exit the institution. They restrict an individual's religious practice or beliefs. They limit the ability of a resident to select or remove support staff. So you have no choice in whoever the person is who provides the support that you need. It restricts the resident's sexual preferences or activity. It requires residents to change housing if they wish to make changes in the personnel who provide their support or the nature of the support. They also restrict access to telephone and internet, and they restrict access to broader community life and activities. So if you look at this description, I'm sure you can tell that if this kind of restriction was applied to your own life as a person without a disability, or if you're listening and you do have a disability, you know that it doesn't sound like a great deal for people. But there are a lot of misconceptions, a lot of myths related to institutional care in the state of Illinois and elsewhere across the country. First of all, some institutions, myth number one is that some institutions must remain open to provide residential and therapeutic services for populations that are the most difficult to serve in the community, including people who are medically fragile, those who are duly diagnosed with intellectual disability and developmental disability and mental illness, and those who are involved with the criminal justice system. But with that, 10 states and the District of Columbia have closed all of their state-run institutions. We spoke with Jennifer Knapp just a couple of weeks ago from Oregon, and they closed their last institution several years ago. And it seems that people with disabilities, even those with the most significant disabilities, have the right to live in their chosen communities close to family and friends with the supports and services they need to be safe, productive, and engaged with family and friends as they choose. One method that is used, certainly in Oregon and some of the other states that have been discussed that have closed their institutions, they use person-centered planning. Person-centered planning delves into the person with a disability and those who know them the best to talk about what their hopes and dreams are, what their gifts are, what their needs are for support, and where would be the best place and the best day. What would the best day look like for that person? Doing that one person at a time makes it much more feasible to change the system as a whole. The second myth is that people who are currently housed in institutions are more severely disabled than those who live in the community, but no evidence shows that they can be served effectively in the community, which is completely off base. I was involved with the closure of one institution in Jacksonville several years ago. And when I was there, I was in charge of doing some person-centered plans for some of the residents. And one of the guys that I did a plan for was completely capable of explaining what his needs were, what he wanted in his life. I don't really have time to go into the details, but let me tell you, the description that he gave bared little resemblance to what he was actually living while living in that institution. So it's really unnecessary for that to happen, for sure. One other myth is that closing institutions does not save money. Well, that's not true either. State legislators have expressed concern that closing institutions and expanding community-based services would result in a woodwork effect. They contend that if states make it easy for people to get Medicaid to help pay for services in their homes, many people would want those services. And currently, people rely on unpaid help from family and friends to stay out of institutions. But once states start offering a decent supply of in-home services, people will come out of the woodwork and start asking for them. So they say, we can't offer it because there are too many people that are going to want that. So to argue that a state should maintain institutions rather than expand community services because too many people might want the latter is to argue that it is appropriate for the state to ration care by offering services that nobody wants. In reality, most people with intellectual disability or developmental disability who would access services if they were available are already out of the woodwork. They are on waiting lists. The states already have some estimate of the number of people who would use the services if they were available. And in Illinois right now, that number is upward of 14,000 people. Another myth is that funding for people with developmental disabilities comes from state and local taxes, which is absolutely not the case. The majority of funding comes from the federal government in the form of Medicaid, which is designed for institutions. Those are called intermediate care facilities, and Medicaid also provides funding to people with developmental disabilities to live in the community in the form of home and community-based waivers. States are able to change the way they utilize those funds, and 11 of them have. So it is much more flexible than governments and agencies would allow you to believe. The fifth myth is that people in institutions can't be moved to their chosen communities because they'd have to go to the back of the line on waiting lists. As I mentioned just a moment ago, it is true that Illinois has a waiting list for services. It's called PUNS, which stands for Prioritization of Urgency of Needs. Currently, almost 1,000 people in East Central Illinois alone are on that waiting list. That number is down significantly in the past few years, but because of the Liggett's Consent Decree, which forced the state to provide funding to more people, people in institutional care could have their funding converted to home and community-based waivers to provide whatever they need immediately. They would not have to be on that waiting list if the state made that choice for them. What's happening right now is if somebody leaves an institution, that funding that supported that individual is just rolled back into the institutional system and does not provide services for that person outside unless the state chooses to do that. Now, they are doing that more often than they used to, but it's not a standard practice just yet. Another myth is that the lives of people with intellectual disability and developmental disability don't change that much when they leave the institution and move to the community. But life in the community provides the possibility for, as my good friend Lester Pritchard used to say, freedom and dignity and a sense of belonging. Freedom, dignity, choice, and a sense of belonging that is not possible in an institutional setting. It affects interpersonal relationships and interactions. Just through the relationships that people have in the community and the supports that they receive. It provides social inclusion, community integration and participation, having a role in your community in whatever way you're able to participate in that, whether that's going to church or a club or shopping in town. There are so many ways to give examples of that, and just social supports, having neighbors and friends that know you and care about you. Another thing that the community provides that is not provided in institutional care is self-determination, making your own decisions, having some personal control and goals and personal values. Not everybody in an institution has the ability to take advantage of that because those choices are taken away from them. Another thing that they have out of the institution are rights, human rights, for respect, for dignity, for equality, and legal rights like citizenship, access, and due process. All of those things are afforded to people who live in the community, not so much for people who live in institutional care. Another advantage shown by research is that people who live in the community who have disabilities are better off materially. They have a little bit better financial status. They may have jobs that provide them a little bit of extra money, and they can take advantage of housing programs and creative housing options. There is much more opportunity for personal development in the community, for education, to increase your personal competence, take a class here or there, and to develop skills in things that you're interested in. Another advantage is your emotional well-being. People who are living in their own homes or a family home and have friends and all those things that we enjoy in our lives if we don't have a disability, research shows that that creates a much better state of emotional well-being for those individuals. And lastly on the list, and I know there's more than that, but we don't have much time for it. So the physical well-being, health and health care is better outside of the institution, and activities of daily living can include things like going to the gym, leisure activities like going out and listening to music, and all those things are easily accomplished with supports in the community. So moving on to the next topic, because I am running out of time here. Another myth is that we should keep institutions open to retain good jobs in the small towns and rural areas where many of those institutions are located. Communities really believe that closure would devastate their local economy, and they have reacted with outrage, and unions representing staff have rallied to prevent the loss of jobs. Funding people, or holding people with disabilities hostage to their local economy concerns is viewed by advocates as inappropriate treatment of people with disabilities. As one very good friend of mine said to me, you know, you shouldn't have a job that's based on keeping a person with a disability prisoner in a place where they don't want to be. Some states have actually created closure commissions to study the impact of closures on residents, their families, workers, and the economy of the community. And concern over that economic impact of the closure of a large public employer is not unique to institutions that house people with disabilities. Similar debates occur where governments close military bases or prisons or other correctional facilities. States really have shifted their positions from the institution to the community in those states where institutions have closed, and those workers remain employed and involved, but they work in the community rather than in an institution. California, Georgia, Kansas, Pennsylvania, Oregon, and Wisconsin have all used this strategy. If California can do it, if Pennsylvania can do it, it could work in Illinois. It is true that employees of state institutions get better salaries and benefits, and they should retain those as community-based support professionals. And those who are currently employed as community-based support professionals should get the same. Right now, they don't. You may remember hearing on this program that it costs $286,000 a year per person to house a person in an institutional setting. That could go a long way to providing really good services in the community for people. Another myth is that people with intellectual disability who live in the community experience higher mortality than those who receive care in an institutional setting. Totally false. Another myth is that Well, I could go on. I'm running out of time. I'm looking at the clock and saying, okay, I've got no time for this. So the myths that you've heard so far during this show, why do so many people believe in them? Well, historically, people with disabilities have been in isolated settings like institutions, group homes, sheltered workshops, and day programs, isolated with other people who have disabilities. Not because they've chosen those settings, but because society has historically limited people's choices and ultimately narrowed the vision of communities and families. Several years ago, a listener called after one of my programs and said, "Hey, I never knew there were issues regarding the way people with disabilities are treated. I always thought people were just taken care of." How does that happen? Why do you suppose intelligent people believe that and the other myths that we've discussed? My personal opinion is that we are groomed for those beliefs from a young age. Those of us born decades ago never knew many people with developmental disabilities unless there was a person in their family who was disabled. Kids with disabilities may have been in our schools, but many were in separate special schools or maybe special classrooms in a separate wing of the building. They were kept separate at all costs, in many cases arriving late and leaving early on a short bus, and sometimes having lunch together or recess on the playground at times when typically developing children were not present. Those practices taught us to expect less from our children with disabilities, to expect a world with institutions, group homes, and other special places. But what many of us have learned is that what people need are not lives that are different from ours. They need the same thing we do. But with technology, education, and relationships, and individualized supports that give them a quality of life that compares to any average person without a disability. In recent decades, more kids with disabilities have been successfully included in general education classes with kids who don't have disabilities. They have extra supports and accommodations made to help them be successful as they are able, and they don't have to reach the standards set for other kids. They achieve as compared to themselves and their own growth. Many parents of kids with disabilities today don't have the perception that their kids don't belong with other kids. They do belong, and it's our responsibility as a community to help make that happen in whatever way we are able. You may have heard literally hundreds of times, if you are a regular listener of this program, that I am the parent of a young woman with a disability. I would never choose an institution for my daughter, Annie, nor would I choose a group home, a sheltered workshop, or a day program. All our decisions have been based on what Annie wants for her own life, and that is always what guides us. She wants to live in her own place, have fun with friends, work out at the local gym, attend basketball, baseball, and football games of her favorite teams, go to Friday Night Live on Friday night, see movies, go shopping, and maybe even have a job again once we get through this whole COVID disaster. That's her idea of a good life, and our goal is to help her make that happen and keep it happening even when we're gone. It benefits not only Annie, but also her community, who see her in a different light than they may have if she had been born even just 50 years ago. And that's my take on institutionalization. I don't give my opinion very often. I hope I didn't bore you too much with it. Thanks for listening today, and we'll see you next week. This and other episodes of Disability Beat are available at weft.org/public affairs. For updates and information, join our Facebook page at Disability Beat Radio. To share ideas for guests or topics, email Vicki at disabilitybeat@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in, and have a great rest of your week.
Down, gonna stand my ground, and I won't back down.
You are tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. Coming up next is Food Sleuth Radio, so stay tuned for that and other great programs here on WEFT Community Radio all evening long. And be sure to check out our website at weft.org. It's really simple to make a donation there to give your support to the great work that is done here at this volunteer-operated organization. And without further ado, here is Food Sleuth Radio.